This is Carolina Business Review. Major support provided by Colonial Life, providing benefits to employees to help them protect their families, their finances, and their futures. High Point University, the premier life skills university, focused on preparing students for the world as it is going to be. Sunoco, a global manufacturer of consumer and industrial packaging products and services, with more than 300 operations in 35 countries.
There seems to be paradoxical and conflicting economic data right now around the economy and our general business climate. Welcome again to the most widely watched and the longest running program on Carolina business, policy, and public affairs, seen every week in North and South Carolina. I'm Chris William. In a moment, we will start with experts from North Carolina's Triangle and the Lowcountry in South Carolina. And speaking of South Carolina, Garden and Gun Magazine, based in Charleston, has a lot of notable success. Joining us later is the Senior Vice President and Editor-in-Chief, David DiBenedetto. Stay with us.
Major funding also by Blue Cross Blue Shield of South Carolina, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association, and Martin Marietta, a leading provider of natural resource-based building materials, providing the foundation on which our communities improve and grow. On this edition of Carolina Business Review, Aaron Nelson from the Chamber for a Greater Chapel Hill Carborough, Dr. Tanya Matthews of the International African American Museum, and special guest David DiBenedetto, Senior Vice President and Editor-in-Chief of Garden and Gun Magazine.
Hello, welcome again to our program. We're glad you're joining us. Also joining us virtually from Chapel Hill is, of course, Aaron Nelson. And also from Charleston in South Carolina's Lowcountry is Dr. Tanya Matthews. Welcome to you both. Good to see you. Tanya, I wish you could experience Aaron Nelson in our studio, but you're not going to be able to this time. And I'll just leave it there. He's a great energy to be around, and I'm halfway kidding about that because we like having him and would love to have you in the studio. So, Aaron, boy, what a setup. Let me start with you. You know, so the economy's good. These are good problems to have. However, what shows up in places like Orange County in North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Carborough, is very expensive housing. And Aaron, I don't think I'm over the tips of my skis. This is forcing people to move, isn't it?
Yeah. When we survey, and Chris, it's really good to see you, and Tanya, I hope to meet you in person. When we survey businesses about what their top challenges, they say the top challenge is finding and keeping employees. And when we ask them what they attribute that to, they say the cost and availability of housing. It is the top challenge. The average cost of a home, the transaction value, is over $600,000 here in Orange County and also in Chatham County. And that is not dissimilar in the counties around us. And we're going to have to, as a community, both public and private sector, find some solutions. Traditional models have worked really well, from habitat housing to some government supported, but we think there's some new models that are really going to help bring more housing faster, and we're going to have to prioritize that if local businesses are going to continue to be successful and
Aaron,
find the workers that they need.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Aaron. Have you reached a tipping point? It seems like it's kind of that, no?
Well, there are places that we can see that have been through this before. A recent trip, our community went out to Boulder, Colorado, and 10 years ago, it was $900,000 split-level ranches from the 1950s. And commuting was the solution. People just drive further and further away, which is driving up wages, which is also leading to sprawl, which makes it so that transit doesn't work. We want to bring more people proximate to their places of employment. And I think there's zoning regulations, some state laws that could change, and some new strategies to bring the housing. But it has to be the business community's a key top priority.
Tanya, this can't be unfamiliar in the Lowcountry at all.
You know, it is. It's not unfamiliar at all. You know, as a new resident, less than 5 years, and a new employer, I'm definitely resonating with what Aaron is saying. Of course, Charleston is the destination, if I may say so myself, and there are incredible economic drivers that are positive in that space. But when it comes to things like housing and affordability, it is something that we're grappling with, particularly since one of the reasons why we are such the place to be is to see homegrown culture. Well, if homegrown culture has got to move 45 minutes out of town, you're not going to get to see what you came to see when you come into downtown Charleston. And of course, we just opened, and the issue around supporting employees and employee travel, employee housing, hybrid work environments do not fix everything. So I'm definitely resonating with the points that Aaron is making.
So when, you know, we're talking about it now, it's been talked about over and over. It's talked about in community meetings. You all just made the good argument right now. Is this something we just need to deal with? Just need to know, in your case, Tanya, that people are going to be driving in from Pinopolis or Orangeburg just to get to work in Charleston? I know that sounds a little bit dramatic, but is it a tipping point for you?
No, I think that is a dramatic question, but it's a good question because, for example, one of the reasons that I've enjoyed being here, I'm a Washington, D.C. native, okay? So when you want to talk about the two-hour commute, it's the nature of the beast there. But it was part of my decision to think about coming here. And we've got several folks who are from the Lowcountry who work for the museum and some folks who have come in. And I do have to say that the issue of commute is actually a question. And where and how folks live is a question right along with the salary. And you can only raise salary so much because I think folks are thinking a little more clearly about work-life balance, travel, childcare, all of that starts to become a factor when you talk about folks having to move farther and farther out just to get to work.
In 2003, both North and both South Carolina had posted some of the biggest numbers ever in economic development, Aaron. And a lot of those projects are big projects. I'm not going to go down the list, but it's tens of billions of dollars. It's thousands of employees. And while this sounds good on the surface, it does create these issues of housing. So I want to come back to this idea that the Carolinas are experiencing tremendous growth. How do we manage this growth? And I'm speaking to you as an economic developer in a very core part of North Carolina. What would you say, instead of just living with the problem, that North Carolina can be doing proactively?
Well, I think that we just are going to prepare for more housing that people can't, the NIMBYism isn't going to work anymore. Wake County's grown by 65 people a day. Our community's not growing that quick. There's a lot of folks coming, and we're going to have to build the housing. And it's not going to be all single family, large lot. We're going to do multifamily. We're going to have to look at different models. And I think employers can get involved. First, we got to build it, right? We got to make sure we have the infrastructure, the roads, the transit. But that is eminently accomplishable. And we've seen other regions handle that well. They've been there before. But then I think then there'll be strategies on how to make it more affordable. Everything from down payment assistance that an employer might offer as a forgivable loan to direct rent support. We do it for healthcare. We help pay the healthcare of some of our employees. And maybe housing support may be a thing we're going to need to do to recruit and retain.
Do you get the sense there's going to be some political softness to entertain just what you said?
I mean, we already have the legislature thinking about how they might remove some of the authority from local governments that they'll get involved to make it easier to build housing. Yeah. That local zoning regulations that have made it difficult in some places might be relieved. But we're going to have to build it if our economy is going to continue to grow.
We've got a couple minutes before we bring on our guest. Before we do that, I want to get to something that's good, purely good. And congratulations, Dr. Matthews, on the opening of the International American African American Museum in the Lowcountry. Wow. What a wonderful event. But now you're open for business. And now some things are emerging for you. You have a fresh set of eyes living in the South, certainly in the Lowcountry. Mm-hmm. What has become apparent? And I want to ask you specifically, and I'm not answering my own question, but the idea of cultural tourism certainly has been highlighted. But what else?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. You know, for folks who may not have picked up on it, we just opened in June 27th of 2023. So we are still less than a year in the game after about a 23-year journey to get to this space. Cultural heritage tourism is definitely part of the business sector that we support. But it's interesting because particularly Charleston, the Lowcountry as a whole, tourism history is our business, right? So the tourism is our business. history is our brand. And so what the museum represented, I think, is a filling out of that story. That folks have been really excited. We just got the results back from our economic impact study, and it was upwards of $40 million in the first 6 months of operation. And I think that's because, you know, there's an itching for this story. We didn't create it. We are just, I think, the newest tool in the toolbox. And a lot of the stories we tell have been, of course, circulating in the Lowcountry, South Carolina, dare I say the nation, for several hundred years.
Well, thank you. I wish we could unfold that a little bit more. But again, congratulations. It's a wonderful event, of course, but also a lot of promise. We're going to bring our guest in. It is hard not to compare the old Southern Living magazine meme or theme to the new Garden and Gun publication. They certainly seem similar. But Garden and Gun is seemingly breaking some publishing rules. It's still a heavy, hard copy of a coffee-sized table kind of a publication. Most other pubs have gone online, solely online. But Garden and Gun, what is their brand? How do they define success and their audience? Joining us now from Charleston again is the editor-in-chief, David DiBenedetto. David, welcome to the program. Nice to see you, sir.
Nice to see you. Thanks for having me.
So, David, you've heard some of the conversation. We're not going to go down that road, maybe later on in the dialogue. But, you know, Garden and Gun, I say it kind of, it breaks rules. You have a hard copy, it's delivered, you have subs, it's being mailed. What is the spirit of Garden and Gun? What is it?
You know, great question, right? I think overall, the mag is a celebration of the South that we love, right? So we're covering food, music, art, literature. And what certainly separates us from other magazines is our coverage of the sporting culture. That is such a big part of the Southern DNA, and also this appreciation of the land where that sporting culture happens. But there's also a commitment here to top-notch writing, photography, and using that to tell the stories of the South and its people. But I got to say, we're also not a magazine that's afraid to acknowledge our very difficult history. And again, happy when we can celebrate stories that show we're moving forward.
The audited subscriber base is almost half outside the South. How do you define the audiences? How do those two audiences live together?
Well, what's really great about the audience, and doesn't happen in a lot of magazines, is we're also split down the middle. There's the demographic is, you know, 48% female, 52% male, right? So that rarely happens. And what I start with is we need to make a magazine that's interesting to anybody who picks it up. Every page has to matter. Every story has to be interesting from start to end. And that may sound simple, but that's not the way it's always done, right? And we come out six times a year, which allows every issue to be a bit of an event. You know, when a magazine comes out 12 times a year, like the old days when there was no internet and it was all, you know, magazines were having their heyday, we could admit that. You know, they came and went. I think when G&G arrives, it's a bit of an event. And when you talk about those folks out of the South, outside of the South, who love G&G, and we get my earpieces keep falling off. We get those letters that they either are expats who have moved out or folks who just appreciate the lifestyle.
We're going to open up the panel. Aaron, please go first.
We are seeing locally real strong interest in the physical, beautiful, well-written, somehow it feels refreshing, shift away from the scanning. Are you seeing advertisers also sort of lean in and wanting to spend more, and is circulation growing?
So, yes. I mean, what's great about G&G, which we can say to readers, to advertisers, to anyone out there, well, what we can say to advertisers and is that our readers actually read the magazine. They read every page. You know, I've been in this business for 25 years. I spent 12 years in New York City at Winter Media, men's magazines, outdoor magazines. I've never been at a magazine where the mailbag is consistently full, right? We're touching folks in a way that matters to them, and they appreciate it, and they want to talk about it. And I can promise you, when we get it wrong, they let us know that too. But there is an appreciation for what we're doing, and I believe because people are so engaged with the content, they're also engaged with the ads. And to the publisher's credit, to our publisher's credit, the ads very much feel organic to the pages.
Dr. Matthews?
You know, it's great to chat with you, David, because the one thing folks don't think I Am and G&G would have so much in common, but the thing we right. do have in common is that we have incredible stories and incredible right. visuals, right? And there's often this sense right. the photographer's like, no, this picture will say all the words. And the writer's like, yeah, no, you're gonna need some words with that picture and vice versa. So talk a little bit, because I love the visuals in Garden and Gun. So talk a little bit about how you balance or think about curating the visuals with the stories that you're telling.
Yeah, I mean, that commitment to photography has been there from the very first day. And I have to say, Garden and Gun was founded in 2007. I came down from New York City in 2008. So, you know, a year into it. And that was already in place. And, you know, it also starts, you know, early on, we mentioned the quality of the paper. Right. Everything about it is almost luxe in a big production. And the quality of the paper makes those images stand out and stand up. And for me, you know, I want every page of the magazine to excite you, to interest you, to make you curious. And, you know, we spend, it shouldn't be any surprise, right? Anything you do well, you work really hard on, and you get this. We spent hours and hours and hours just thinking about what image might work on a two-page spread or what two images or, you know, editors and I will talk about a headline for hours till sometimes I drive them crazy. But, you know, I like to say every word matters. I mean, it does. And when it comes to images, it's even more important. I mean, it sets the tone. And thankfully, we've been able to keep and stay with that great quality of paper and number of pages. I mean, you know, the magazine always lands with a thud, and I mean that in a good way. It's nice to be able to say that, because you get some in the mail these days, and I love these magazines, but, you know, they're paper thin.
David, AI, of course, it's all the rage now, even though it's been around for a long time. But how do you embrace AI, and how do you do it in a way that does not undermine integrity when it comes to writing?
I mean, when it comes to writing, I can't say that I know that answer yet. I mean, we are certainly waiting it out to see how it may be beneficial, but not in a way that undermines the quality of what we do, right? I mean, there may be ways that AI comes to us and you know, I heard someone talking about a program now that can look at covers and the covers of your competitors and analyze what words worked and what words didn't. And, you know, that might be interesting, but when it comes to writing, I'm not comfortable with any use of it so far. And again, I might sound like a dinosaur, and things may change, but I think everything about Garden and Gun is almost the opposite of AI.
Aaron?
As you tell the story of the South, what role do you think you play in, I don't know, affirming stereotype or breaking them? Do you go out of your way to
I think breaking them, you know, like for instance, like we don't use the word Dixie in our magazine, right? We're not showing Confederate flags. I mean, that's not the South that we are. I mean, my South, my team's South is an inclusive South, and happy to champion the stereotypes of family and tradition and, you know, the things that, you know, this appreciation of the land, if you want to call those stereotypes, but certainly trying to avoid the cliches and especially the ones that don't, that just reflect poorly on us.
Tanya?
Well, you know, you kind of just sort of opened up a nice door there, David, because when you say the words Southern culture, it's never just one thing, right? I mean, A, it's a big old region. And B, you know, as the heart of the nation, we've got everything here. So you do have these conversations around diversity. And I can just imagine the challenges around, say, curating the different stories. So how does G&G sort of approach the broad diversity of Southern culture? Culture when you're trying to think about what to feature, what to talk about.
Yeah, and I'll say that we've learned a lot over the years how to be better at it. You know, when I started in 2008, we thought about, you know, diversity in the pages, right? We wanted to reflect a diverse South. As time went on, we realized, well, we need to also let people of color tell the stories of other people of color, right? So it became, not only are we gonna be diverse in our pages, but our storytellers, that we're gonna share the mic with a diverse group of storytellers, photographers, illustrators. And so, it, you know, a complete package. And, you know, we strive, it's top of mind all the time. To represent what we consider the South, you know, that very varied South. And as you mentioned, like, I love it, the global South. It's so many times, so many cultures piling into recipes and dishes, and that's who we are now, right?
So since we're on easy topics, let's talk about the actual brand itself, Garden and Gun. The term gun is exclusionary and it's exclusionary at the same time. It's an interesting term. So what does gun mean? And I guess then what does garden mean?
Right. Yeah. So quickly, the name of the magazine was inspired by a club in Charleston called the Garden and Gun Club, which was around in the 70s. And as I understand it, it was very much the Studio 54 of the South. And when the bars would close, everybody ended up at the Garden and Gun Club, and it was the best party in town, which is what I kind of love. Right. There it is, that very inclusive idea from the beginning. But the other thing that I think the founders of this magazine liked was that Garden and Gun spoke to the male female readership. It spoke to the appreciation of the land and the use of the, you know, the sporting culture that we were going to cover. But you're right, I mean, gun is a tough word. There's no doubt about that. You know, we have those discussions. You know, it's, I usually start by telling people who have never heard about the magazine, it's not about gardens or guns. It's a Southern lifestyle magazine.
Yeah, that's probably a good way to couch it. Aaron, we have about 2 minutes left.
I was just going to ask, so is it creating a challenge for you? Are you having to lately spend more time explaining it, or is it such a unique name that it's to your benefit?
I would say it's a blessing and a curse, right? In so many ways, it's been a wonderful name that grabbed attention and people remember it, and it speaks to folks and on different levels. And then on the opposite side of that, there are folks who just hear the word gun and react to it in a way that we wouldn't want them to. So, the best answer to that is, please just open up the magazine, right? You know, if you see that what it's really about, and sure, we cover the sporting culture, which involves guns, but this is not a magazine about handguns or gun rights or, you know, rifles or anything like that. It's, you know, we're talking about $40,000 shotguns. I will say, as we mature, it's something we think about and talk about a lot.
About a minute and a half, Tanya, quick question maybe?
Sure. Last thing, you told us that your readership is almost 50-50, male and female. We know our magazines are separate. So what do you think is the secret sauce behind that statistic?
You know what's funny? I think what was smart, you know, when this magazine was invented, it scratched an itch that wasn't being scratched. You know, these people weren't being talked to. This type of demographic, they certainly were. And again, I'll go back to storytelling. What we do really well is tell interesting stories. And, you know, say we're writing about a home. I don't want that story. You might think that might, you know, like style, interior design, that might only be of interest or more interest to women. it's not that. I mean, we always say, like, we want a home that, if those walls could talk, we want them talking. We want every story to appeal to whoever picks it up, and I want them to be surprised by it. The number of letters we get from readers who might say, like, I've never fly fished in my life, but I read the profile of Lefty Cray, and now I want to go pick up a fly rod. So it's just, I think it's really about creating great content and just putting it out there for people to consume.
We literally have 30 seconds, David. I want to ask you this, and I don't want to compare and contrast, but you got to think of Southern Living. I mean, did they blaze the trail for you? They had to.
Southern Living is the behemoth, right? I mean, they're still the biggest. I'm friends with some of the folks over there. They do it really well. And yes, back in the day, Southern Living was a little bit more broad than they are now. But they found their groove and they're successful, and we've kind of found ours. And it's a happy competition, I should say.
Oh, that's a good way to put it. That's the last word. David, thank you for taking time to join us. Dr. Matthews, thank you for joining us. Aaron, always nice to see you. And best of spring luck to all of you. And David, thanks for squarely planting the brand in Charleston.
Yes. I love to be here. I was happy to move from New York City back to the Low Country.
Thank you. Take care. Good night, now.
Gratefully acknowledging support by Martin Marietta, Blue Cross Blue Shield of South Carolina, Sunoco, High Point University, Colonial Life, and by viewers like you. Thank you. For more information, visit carolinabusinessreview.org.